Hey, movie fans, Dimitri here for Popcorn Talks, Anatomy of a Movie, where today we talk about Life, the sci-fi horror movie, not the cereal.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talks, Anatomy of a Movie.
Hello, everybody, and again, this is Dimitri from Popcorn Talks, Anatomy of a Movie, where today we're going to talk about Life. And speaking of Life, we spent a lot of lifetime together with my great co-host, Marissa Serafini.
Yes.
How are you?
Hello, Dimitri. I'm back. Marissa Serafini. Follow me on Twitter at SerafiniTV. I'm good. How are you?
I'm just shiny. Thanks for asking. Yeah, I mean, it's been a while since it's just been the two of us.
Just us two.
It's nice. We're very nice and intimate, and we're talking about a movie that falls within your favorite genre of movies, horror. I mean, it's
It depends on, like, what version of horror it is. Like, the slasher horror. Like, one by one, I'm going to kill you for the fun of it, sadistic way. Yeah, no, I'm not, like, I don't like that. And the ones with the cheap jump scares,
sure,
and all that, like, you know, Annabelle, Conjuring, all those crazy scary movies that are purposely there to scare you. No, I don't like that. But thrillers, psychological thrillers, I do like.
Sure.
You know, some of my favorite shows are actually the horror shows.
Yeah, well, you and I didn't really get to, sometimes we talk before we come into the studios. Hey, it's all good. It's all good. That's our producer there taking care of the ones
and
twos.
Technical issues, but whatever. We'll roll.
You know, we're just moving forward. It's all good.
This is life.
This is life.
this is life
on the set of Anatomy of a Movie. So I was saying, like, you and I didn't, like, sometimes we talk before, you know, just to get general thoughts and whatever. And I know when I was going into seeing the movie, I was actually thinking about, geez, I wonder how, you know, Marissa's going to, you know, handle this movie. Mm-hmm. So go ahead. So what were your thoughts? I'm curious.
You know, I actually enjoyed it. I mean, I think a lot of people are going to probably automatically make the comparisons to Alien or The Thing or any extraterrestrial that's out in space that you can't really pinpoint or understand or conceptualize. Yeah, you're gonna make those comparisons. But I enjoyed it because I think the fun aspect of it and the fact that they kept it a small crew made it a little bit more intimate, especially the claustrophobia. I thought the cinematography was fantastic in the show, in the movie, and we'll definitely talk about it, but I enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of got that feeling immediately from Alien, especially the opening shot when you hear the voiceover and all that. It's like, oh, it's going to be another Alien. But I liked the pacing of it and the fact that it was a kind of a shorter horror movie. Mm-hmm. Not once did I lose my attention to this. You know, it kept me engaged throughout the whole thing. I thought it was just visually beautifully done, mm-hmm, and how they executed it.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and you're right. There are so many movies you can compare this to. I mean, first and foremost, it makes no bones about being an Alien gravity thing, like, knockoff.
Oh, yeah.
This is a B movie. You know,
it's B?
Yeah, I think it's a B movie because it definitely isn't as good as, it's not as good as Alien or Gravity or The Thing, but of all, and there have been plenty of Alien knockoffs since that movie has come out,
right,
this one's one of the more enjoyable ones. You know, I think Daniel Espinosa does a good job in the directing and the pacing. And you're right, the movie does what it has to do. You know, one of the things that I felt it stayed clear from is it never became schlocky like some of those B movie knockoffs could be.
Schlocky in what way?
Well, it was never schlocky. Like, it wasn't like,
what do you define schlocky?
Cheesy effects, dialogue,
over the top,
you know, silliness. You know, just like what you would expect from a B, C, or D movie.
Uh-huh.
It stayed away from that. And all the while, though, you know, it still has its issues, maybe from a story standpoint, but I enjoy the ending. I agree with you that keeping it small, in a sense, you did each character you got to sort of know. So it raised the stakes because eventually, you know, in one way, shape, or form, people are going to die. And in order for, you know, you sort of kind of have to care for the characters. Like, there's got to be something that you sort of kind of like care about in order for you to take you through the sci-fi horror adventure. It's horror light. I mean, it had just enough suspense, but it wasn't alien, gut-wrenching, edge of your seat, like, oh my god, where's this thing gonna, like, it was well done. I thought, like, you know, I was thinking about you, going, she could handle this.
Oh, yeah, totally. And that's what I was, like, telling other people. I was like, I wasn't scared about this film at the end. And, like, it didn't get me nightmares. I didn't really get a lot of those cheap jump scares that, you know, most horror movies give you. I thought this was tolerable, and I would probably watch this movie again compared mm-hmm. to other horror movies that I would only watch once.
Yeah.
If I ever got to them.
Yeah, and there were parts like the end, which we'll talk about. You know, it was a nice twist. It was a nice Twilight Zone.
I saw that kind coming.
I mean, you sort of see it coming, but still, I like the attempt at doing mm-hmm. something a little bit different. And it was good. It was like it was a tragic ending, in a sense.
Oh, yeah. What I liked about this film, and we'll definitely get into it when we talk about the cast and whatnot, but the fact that they didn't... There wasn't that one over-the-top character that you're like, oh, what are they doing here? You know, that's annoying, or, like, is purposely the antagonist that spoil everything and just, like, ruin the moment. And, you like, and then that becomes the bigger issue than the actual problem at hand. And I'm glad we didn't get one of those characters that you're like, just get them out of here, you know?
Yeah. I agree. I agree with you. And, like, even when you look at an alien, they're, you know... Again, when you're talking about the Nostromo crew, who are blue collar workers, like these are right here in life, they're actual astronauts. I know that they very hard try to make it science reality as opposed to like science fiction.
Right.
And you know, it even had its quote unquote psycho moment in the movie by killing off a main character within the first 15 minutes of the mm-hmm. movie. So again, you've seen life in many other iterations before, done better, but it's still enjoyable because it's, you know, it's a good knockoff that you know, like some knockoff jeans, I guess, that aren't going to explode after their first wash.
We could call it Alien Light.
Alien Light, Horror Light. So why don't we get into some of the... Well, what brought life to life?
The development.
Yeah. And in part, a lot of it was Daniel Espinosa, and he was approached to do this. And he had worked with Ryan Reynolds before in Safe House, which mm-hmm. not a bad movie, by the way. Safe House is pretty decent. And you know, he talks about he's a big fan of science fiction, and what really grabbed him was because of it being in the world of science fiction, because it's of the unknown. There's fear and fascination. And there is fascination in science. And there could be fear, in which this movie sort of kind of proves. And, you know, I like that he was a fan of that. And you know, this movie does have fascination. It builds fascination. And through that fascination, they build on the fear aspect of this movie, which I thought was pretty good.
Espinosa said David Ellison, who actually is the head of Skydance, had this vision for a movie where they would bring back samples of life from Mars to the International Space Station for a study, and it grows where it's exposed to the atmosphere and it starts to attack the crew. So that's, you know, the genesis of it all. And so Ellison pitches that at the general launch, because they did G.I. Joe Retaliation together. Mm-hmm. Over at Paramount, he pitched the idea, and a few months later, pretty much they wrote the screenplay for it.
I think it's also good to know that Ellison, David Ellison, his sister is Megan Ellison, who heads Annapurna. So it's really great, like, because you have these two, they're very wealthy kids, but who had passion for movies. And one more of the independent route, that's Megan. And one more of the commercial route, obviously Dave. And they've each had their very modicum of success in setting up their production companies. And I think Megan Ellison just set up, not only does she have a production company, Annapurna, but now Annapurna is a distribution company, much like a studio. So I really applaud these siblings for doing this, for work, well, for working. What Megan Ellison is, for their passion. Megan Ellison is a strong, powerful woman in Hollywood. David Ellison's doing his job in making good commercial fare, but together making different types of movies and offering that variety to audiences, I think is fantastic. I just love it. And so, you know, and then one of them would make a sci-fi horror movie. That's what Mr. Ellison does. Yeah. And I really like that. And then bringing everything all together. They're not the only people. Like, the director, Daniel Espinosa, is not the only person who's worked with Ryan Reynolds before either. You know, Reese and Wernick, the writers of Deadpool, who worked with Ryan Reynolds, they came up with the script. So that's another thing about this movie that I sort of like. There are all these various puzzle pieces, and you sort of kind of wonder. So Daniel's like, "Hey Ryan, I have a script," or "Hey Ryan," or "Ryan has a script from these guys that just did Deadpool. What do you think?" Well, yeah, you know, I might have a director in mind. So, yeah, I found that whole thing very, very fascinating. And then Ryan Reynolds, of course, becomes involved with the project.
Yeah, and I think that was great because, you know, I learned after the fact that they also did Deadpool. And I was like, and if you go into the film knowing that, that would have been great. But, like, afterwards, like I did, they're two completely different films.
Oh, absolutely. And
yeah, Ryan Reynolds is probably the similarity between the two. But the tonality and the writing aspect are completely different. Deadpool being its own crazy ad-lib, whatever Marvel movie that right. you want, over the top and, you know, swearing and all that. And compared to this, which is like an actual sci-fi thriller.
Right.
Two completely different genres, and I think they tackled both of them very well.
Yeah, I agree. I think so, too. And what's the other fascinating thing that I found out through research, speaking of Ryan Reynolds, who played Rory Adams, who's the, like, the, we'll call him the mission specialist. He's the spacewalk guy. He's the comedian. Yeah, and
comic relief.
Well, and then you had David Jordan, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, who's the doctor. You know, he's the medic. Interestingly enough, originally planned, their roles are going to be switched. So, you know, it was going to be two different. It would have been. We would have lost Jake Gyllenhaal a lot earlier in the film, other than Ryan Reynolds.
But, you know, I'm glad about this switch because I just think, in not to say that Ryan Reynolds can't get into that emotional depth to be a serious, but I think most people know him more from the comedic side, the lighter type of, you know, acting.
Sure.
Whereas it made sense for his character to be the one who had all the snide remarks.
And yeah.
Stuff. And I can definitely see Jake being the more dramatic one, which is, you know, what David was. So it makes sense that these actors were portrayed in this way.
Yeah, I agree. To flip them too. Yeah, I mean, Rory Adams is the quote-unquote cowboy of the movie, which seems to suit Ryan Reynolds. And I agree. I mean, although, you know, Ryan Reynolds has had his serious roles. He was fantastic in this movie called Buried, I believe it was.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he could pull it off. The One-Man
Show.
Yeah, he could pull it off. But you're right. I think that eventually the swap for this movie's needs, I think it really worked. And
it's not out of the real house.
And also, let's say it stayed the same. You still have the quote unquote shock value of you know, one of your leads. Well known. Like, those are like the two real A-listers in this movie, right? And when one of them dies within the first
time, Rebecca Ferguson's
she's getting up there, but these two have had proven box office success. They've been working for years, and to lose one of these people, because they're usually quote unquote safe.
Right.
Like, you don't hire one of these people to be a hero in the movie and then kill him off within the first 15 minutes. So either way, there would have been that, oh, okay, well, that's fascinating. Where are we going from here? So, it was a decent twist, again, done before, but it was good.
I feel like we're getting into Ryan Reynolds and the casting and the imminent death of his character.
Sure.
Were you surprised by this? I was thoroughly shocked. I figured he would eventually die, but I didn't realize how soon he was going to die.
You know, I wasn't surprised by it because for some reason or another, the schmucks in Sony marketing released either a television spot or something that was online that showed him getting consumed by, like, the alien coming into his mouth. Yeah. And I was like, okay, well, I know he's going to die. And at that point, it wasn't even a question of, like, it didn't matter when in the movie. I just knew already he was going to die. And I was like, what?
Why so it got would ruined you? For you.
Yeah, it did. It really did. Like, you, yeah, I don't know what, I don't know who made that decision to show, yeah, you know, bad you marketing. Have a small crew, but you figure you keep, you know, one of your popular actors that people know, sort of kind of keep that a secret.
Well, you kept Jake Gyllenhaal.
Right.
but I think it was also, like, it was kind of twofold, really, with Ryan Reynolds. First of all, like, he's a bigger name in this film. You weren't expecting him to die.
No.
But also, the way he died was way, like, it was over the top, like, oh my god, that happened. The fact that it crawls into his mouth and actually consumes him from inside out, and just slowly but surely the blood just starts spitting out. Oh my goodness, like, visually it was fantastic.
And it was
horrifying.
It was. I agree.
Absolutely horrific, which made his death, like, really cool, but really terrible at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. And they held on to it.
Oh, yeah. Like, that was a slow
burn. They held on to it. It wasn't like bullet to the head, he's done.
No.
Yeah.
You saw his eyes, like, slowly bleed, and, like, it was a slow burn. We watched him for probably a good minute and a half of just, like, struggling.
We had
immobile.
We had two interesting death scenes. There was that one, you know, which basically sets up how this creature is going to dispatch you.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. It for everybody, and plus it wasn't just for the audience to see. It was for that crew. It was the crew. The ice. You know.
This is what you're dealing with now.
And then there was the drowning in space scene.
Oh, goodness.
Too, which was really sort of kind of freaky as well, because something that I hadn't seen before, and this is the commander, the Russian commander,
mm-hmm.
who I like that actress. But again, now what, upon doing research, what I found out is that is actually sort of kind of based on something that almost happened in real life,
right?
Where fluid was filling up into a true astronaut's helmet, and I'm like, whoa, that's pretty freaky and scary, because you know it's not like you could just lift open
yeah, in space.
So, and that scene too was another prolonged one, because it was almost like a ticking time bomb. Because you're going, what the hell's in her helmet?
Right.
And then it just started filling up, and she's trying to get to an airlock, you know. And then there was the whole, Jake Gyllenhaal really played that scene really well. If we want to, let's break it down a little bit. So he's inside the ship, captain's on the outside. Obviously, there's some semblance of a respect and a mutual relationship and affection for.
Right.
He's the doctor.
The problem is, like, it's a two-person lock.
Yes.
It's like, is that usually the case? I don't know how the, you know, ISS is built, but the fact that, like, that particular door that she was going to was a two-person lock, that the person on the inside and the person on the outside literally had to turn the handle at simultaneously just to open the door.
Which sort of kind
Which
of
was
makes
kind of
sense.
Frustrating to watch. It's like,
from a
is it always like that?
But from a safety standpoint, that would make sense. You wouldn't want somebody to lean on the thing and boom,
pops
and
open.
Then yeah, and then everybody's in vapor lock and they get blasted out into space. But that scene played. You know, it was an emotional scene, and this is what makes it better than, like, the schlocky, you know, alien-type rip-offs. Like, that was an emotional scene, and we're seeing something we really hadn't seen on film before.
Well, it was more so, like, two people working together to try to save her life.
Yeah, and it comes to a point where he's turning, and she's going, counter that. And he's like, no, you're going the wrong way, thinking that she can't see or whatever. But, I mean, she's like, no, she's not.
She's not letting this creature back in.
Yeah, she
It was also really frustrating, too, because drowning, I was like, girl could hold her breath for a long time. Because visually, just on screen, just in real time, took probably about 2-3 minutes just to watch. I was like, no, she would have been dead by now. But for dramatic purposes, how long that they let this play out, it was just horrifying every single second that she's just drowning in her own cooling.
Yeah. Oh, which is poison. So it's not like you're in salt water. I mean, it's no. radiator fluid.
And it's freezing, literally freezing your face off. Yeah. So you're drowning and freezing.
Yeah, it's yeah, that was it was an interesting scene and something that hadn't been done before, but it also had emotional heft to it as well. Mm-hmm. So I really enjoyed how that, well, you know, it was just interesting to see how it all played out. And it built, again, there was some tension in that, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was a very fascinating scene.
And it was also scary because we now know that Kelvin, aptly named Kelvin, the alien, can now survive Kelvin on the outside in space. So really, it's pretty much indestructible at this time. You can't kill it.
Well, that was, I guess, one of my things, because he can survive, but not for... They were ascertaining that he could survive out in space, but not for a prolonged period of time.
Yeah, it still needed oxygen.
It's still... They ascertained that he still needed oxygen, but they couldn't figure out how much oxygen was needed to sustain his, you know, his life. So it was almost made him too indestructible for me. Like, at least in, like, say, Alien, they that crew figured out this creature will respond to fire, you know, the flame. This creature, this life creature, which the whole design and the concept behind it too is pretty cool.
Pretty neat.
But yeah, you're right. He was very resilient to almost everything, it seemed. Whether it be the deep freeze of space, oxygen deprivation, it can hold its breath for a long time.
See, and that was the one thing, because, like, usually every alien has that one weakness, and we didn't really get that in this movie, and I was watching the whole film thinking that, okay, eventually there'll be a moment where they realize this is how we take the alien down. And there wasn't that moment.
No, there wasn't, which
makes
it
tough. So you didn't give me
tough.
Hope that this alien would die.
Yeah, and it's going to make it harder, you know, reaching Earth, so to speak. So just going back, so it was an Italian astronaut that nearly drowned in his suit. And, you know, I mean, drowning is bad enough as it is, but if you're drowning a spacesuit out in space, yeah, you're really screwed.
Now you're really dead.
Yeah. So, and that's another thing too, that the writers and director were talking about, making a movie in space. It's like, we here on Earth, you know, as wanting to explore, you know, why do you climb Mount Everest? You know, these are not hospitable places, and yet we want to go into space, not hospitable. Everything in space, I think there was a line, I'm trying to think if it was in Gravity, there was
can't
a line.
Kill you.
Yeah, everything's trying to kill you out here, just by virtue of that, you know, it's a vacuum.
Yeah.
And I think that they sort of kind of tackle that pretty well in having to, what we have to work with and around to get, so that was pretty, I thought that was pretty well stated in this movie. It's dangerous.
Yeah, and, you know, we've had space films now, like dozens upon dozens of space films, especially within the last few years. I feel like space is becoming, you know, the popular thing to go for movies now, again. And it's not new with us knowing that, like, whatever could happen because you're in space. You pretty much could die at any corner, you know, like, any turn. So it's not a new concept for us. No. You're always on the edge of your seat.
Yeah, and being able to present it in a sort of fresh way, too, is interesting. You know, I had mentioned Gravity before, and speaking of the production, is that some of the people who worked on Gravity, and particularly the wire work, the zero-G effect, worked on this movie as well. And which makes sense, you know, if you're going to try to... You're making a movie in zero-G. And
you want to talk about the zero-G?
Yeah, why not? I mean, because it was a fascinating... It led to a couple of things. It was done really well in this movie.
Oh, yeah. It was seamless, smooth.
It really was. Yeah. Very smooth. And it led to the, you know, homage to Alfonso Cuarón's, like, the opening scene is a one long tracking shot through the space station. And I thought
following George Clooney everywhere.
Yeah, and it was really cool. I felt, so there's a really, like an XD screen, and I felt like the camera was, when the camera was upside down, I felt it turning, and and then realizing, oh, this is all one shot. This is pretty well choreographed.
Yeah. I realized that too, and I was just trying to like pinpoint the frame that they were the quote unquote woodcut.
Right.
And there were moments where they were like really, they go close in on the clothing of like one astronaut from one place to another. I was like, that's where they could do a cut from, like the close up of a you know, their shirt or pants or something. But it was so smooth, and it was like a ballet watching everyone. But it established the space, the visual spatial reasoning that you had in the ISS. It's like it's big, but yet it's still small at the same time. It's very claustrophobic.
Sure.
And you can understand where every room is, who's who, and you immediately got their personalities within the first 10 seconds that they're on screen.
Sure.
Like, oh, that's the cowboy, that's the smart, that's the person who's the engineer, that's the doctor, X, Y, and Z. And I thought it was great, and because I've seen, you know, the trailers and promos and stuff, and the whole catching of the samples, you know, that's a big scene, but I wasn't expecting it in the first 8 minutes in that whole big I thought that would be like a big scene that the movie would lead up to, but the fact that they knocked it out so quickly,
it's a good introduction to the movie, and it's definitely an attention grabber. You know what I found interesting, so you had a stunt team. It was headed by the stunt coordinator by the name of Franklin Henson, and then they had a movement coach, Alexandra Reynolds, to do this, and working with wires, obviously wires. What I did find interesting is that it was specifically said that of this movie, as opposed to Gravity, yes, it was done by wires, very much choreographed camera and whatnot, but a lot of movements were, they had puppeteers, so to speak, for the actors, or for Sandra Bullock, George Clooney. Where in this one, they, because the technology is advanced and it was smooth, as you noticed and said, the actors had to train they trained. There were no puppeteers. They had to act zero-G weightless on the wires, do their tumbles and turns. And I thought that was really fascinating. So they were training about 2 hours a day prior to the production, leading into production. So that to me was by not doing puppeteering, you know, the actors had a little bit more to do, but given a little more leeway as well, it seems, with the new technology.
Yeah, and the cool thing is just how far we've come already since Gravity. And Gravity wasn't that long ago. And I like the fact, because it's we got zero gravity throughout this whole film. And that's what I really enjoyed, because I felt like in Gravity there are moments where she's just sitting in one place. You know, this is not constant movement.
Right.
But I feel like this movie, because there were so many people in this one place, that someone was always moving. Something was always moving, whether it be an object or the actual person moving. So you always felt like you were floating throughout this whole film.
Right. And Olga Dikodivichania, or Naya, I'm sorry about it. We'll just call her Olga, who played Katrina. She's the commander. She talked about her training on this. And she would take time, even if she was just eating food, to pretend she was in zero G. And they said that the trick was not to just slow your movements down, because you have to keep it regular movement, but you had to also, whatever you did, you had to go about your routine at a usual speed, but you happen to be floating while you're doing it. So she watched a lot of NASA video about how these people move around. So I just found that, very interesting. And I guess the hardest one was the actor who played the doctor. He was the most difficult to do. He was because he was a paraplegic.
Ariane Bakari.
Yeah, it's Hugh Dairy. He was a paraplegic, so they needed other harnesses, additional harnessing for him, which made it a little bit more uncomfortable. So he was the most, quote-unquote, difficult to have it mimic the zero-G effect, which makes sense.
Yeah, he had other people had the wires, but he had like three different pieces rigged up to him, like something on his chest that would also constrict his torso movement because he couldn't move his legs, especially when they were spinning or like in a chair, like supine position, that they had to put more restrictions on his body because it would make more sense if his legs weren't moving because he is paraplegic.
Yeah.
But people wouldn't think that.
No.
I didn't.
No. So, nope. No, again, it was done really well. You got the weightlessness down, and they didn't use because a lot of Apollo 13 in order to mimic that effect. They put the cast in what was called the Vomit Comet, which is a rocket which simulated zero G atmosphere, so they would actually be floating. But we've come a long way where they don't have to be put on that and get sick.
Also, the cool thing about Apollo 13 that people might not know is that they were in an actual plane that would go up high enough elevation, and they would actually drop the plane, and then they would film during the dropping moments where they're actually in
zero G.
zero G.
Yeah, and there was none of that here.
So, they had some wirings there, but we've come a long way since.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, and then, then it also involves the prop master, Barry Gibbs, because he's involved in creating pieces of machinery that had to look weightless.
Mm-hmm.
So, one example, an incinerator that is rigged by the astronauts to become a flamethrower. He said, we had to make a heavy piece of machinery light enough for the actors to be able to carry it like there's no weight. That they did achieve with the use of puppeteers. So... Mm. My guess is it was on the it was on the actual prop itself, not on, say, Ryan Reynolds in that scene. And it's very interesting because that's something you gotta think about,
Yeah. Well, we didn't, but they sure did.
Again, I think it just goes to the strains taken to do a good, they spared no expense, in a sense. They wanted to make sure that the detailing was right. And again, this goes back to what I was saying. This is where the movie was not schlocky. You didn't see any wires. Nothing looked... It looked real. It looked real.
It certainly did.
So, I really... I appreciated all that. I also liked... We talked about... You mentioned about going through the ISS, the International Space Station, and its modular... aspect of it.
Oh, the actual look of it. The design.
Yeah. I thought it was very fascinating as well.
It looked pretty. And, going over the notes and all the research that you thought of and I thought of, it's really interesting to learn how they built it. They actually built the set. There's, no CG. That is an actual practical set. And on the Shepperton Studios in the UK. And they had... a lot of technology upgrades, per se, compared to the real ISS. But they built, components and modular designs that would allow them to have, long, continuous takes. The walls can expand and retract. Practical sets would, that you can move the cameras through the locations. I thought it was really neat.
Yeah, I like the fact that they weren't using CG. Everything seemed touchable. Everything seemed
tangible.
And I guess the only thing that they really took liberty on was the kitchen or the dining room, which they say in the real ISS isn't as big. But I get why you do it. It's always great to have, and again, Alien used it, for a key scene, but it's where everybody is able to sit down, take a breather, and talk and be themselves. It's a good character building kind of a thing. So you need a dining room table. I forgive that, because this is it is science fiction, but it still looked real within the confines of the movie. I liked how it was modular. I really got a sense that people, if they were flying through and grabbing onto that lever, that it was real... handle or something like that. So that I thought was a fine attention to detail that just makes watching the movie, it brings you in a little bit more into that setting. And I'm glad that it was built as opposed to it being CG.
Oh, yeah, blue screen or green screen. I liked it, and I feel for, like, a crew of just six people, it makes sense to build an actual set, not constantly have things around them.
Mm-hmm.
When you are in such a confined space, I feel like you benefit more if you actually build something to make it feel confined. Like the movie room
that we covered.
They actually built a room of that small space, and it made you feel like you were in that. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, they did the same thing for this.
And then for this, you can take out paneling, put a camera somewhere.
Exactly.
You don't need the roof for scenes where, you know, so yeah, I get why they did it, but their attention to detail was pretty cool. And what do I know? I'm never gonna get to ISS, so I don't. But to me, it looked pretty real, and so that was pretty cool.
Yeah, and even, you know, the prop master Barry Gibbs, he and his team made up of like 5,000 sachets of foods. Which I found this was interesting. You can look at the videos where, you know, astronauts eat food, and they take it out of packets and it floats. But they said that wouldn't be possible with the Earth's gravity because they are in ISS, right. So they're closer to the gravity. But so they decided on sachets of food where you would, like, snip the top and spoon or squeeze it out like a
packet. Sure. Yeah, and there was not one packet of Tang. On that. Tang was the food of astronauts. The drink of astronauts. That's the reason why I drank it. But, I mean, the mere fact that they made so many packets of food for these to stock.
Yeah.
You know, but... And again, we've all seen... Well, that's the other thing that a movie of today has to contend with. Because of the things of YouTube, you can easily go onto YouTube and do a search of astronauts eating in space, and there's a ton of videos of them with the water and eating the little thing, so we know what it looks like in real life. You have to make sure that it matches, because you can really pick it out if it looks fake today.
Well, they took the time to make it look real,
and they did a good job. So another hurdle that they had to try to that they overcame. The other thing too is that they did attempt to make this science real as opposed to science fiction.
Right.
So they needed technical advisors, and they got two, Dr. Kevin Wong and Dr. Adam Rutherford, who came in to talk about the extreme environments and things. Here's my thing about this movie being called Science Real. I like the concept. picking up a microorganism from Mars, you know, I like that. That could potentially happen. But when I think of science real, especially today, and especially with movies like The Martian, which that to me was science real, you know. Now, being that this is a confines of a horror movie, you know, things have to be elaborate. And fictionalized. What I got was real, is that the sets were real, they were practical, and I got that. But I don't look at this story necessarily as being, like, it wasn't for me like The Martian was really...
Well, like, in fairness, The Martian was more fighting its environments than something actually constantly attacking him.
Where that quote comes from.
What?
He's on Mars. He goes, where everything just wants to kill me.
Oh, yeah.
That's where the cook comes
Exactly. So. But that's the thing. That was his whole dilemma in that movie. Like, he was constantly fighting the environment.
Right.
Whereas this film, you're trying to fight Kelvin, the alien.
Right.
And I think it makes sense with, like, the why people would be upset as the quote-unquote too real. Like, I found an article online, I forget the exact source, where some guy was going off, like, no way would Kelvin actually survive in this space because you would need X, Y, and Z. And I'm like, it's a frickin' movie. He brought up some points, but, you know, the science that they... I thought there was enough science in it for us to believe, like, okay, it needed oxygen, and it is technically a living organism, so something has to feed it.
Mm-hmm.
And how it grows is, like, it fed off of another organism, technically, to build. So, like, I believe the science enough for it to exist in the realm of the story.
Absolutely. And take it a step further, so the character Hugh Derry, who's the, I don't know what you want to call him, like biologist? He's the scientist. He's the scientist.
Well,
who,
they're all technically scientists.
He's the guy that's studying the creature first. So he was actually, he would have trained closer to that of, he was sort of based off this Dr. Rutherford, a British geneticist who has published influential books on the creation of life and the use of genetic modification to make new life forms. So that to me is interesting. So you sort of kind of get his motivation. Then comes to me what the science fiction aspect of this movie is. To me, I've said this many times, science fiction is about, say, the human condition, right? And I was trying to find it in this movie, and I guess the only thing that I could really find was, so when we first meet the alien, it was curious, but it was benevolent.
Yeah.
Let's say there was nothing that was mean. It only got mean when it felt it was
being
threatened and or attacked. Now,
shocked, electrical shocking. Yeah, anyone would be threatened by that.
But to our scientists, you know, it just was a way, a means of trying to wake it up or do whatever. But you're right. It's all about perception. The scientist isn't perceiving this as being evil. It's almost like putting paddles on someone to try to revive them in a hospital. Mm-hmm. Yet the alien says, no, no, no. What the hell are you doing? No, you're a threat. I got to take you down. You got a flamethrower. You're going down.
Yeah.
So I found that to be very interesting. Because it's basically, this is why this creature turns, you know, turns on us. So, you know, it now looks at as humans as the malevolent factor.
Yeah, it was, well, the electrical shock was literally the catalyst for it going off on the humans. And
right.
I thought it was interesting because it seemed like it was a creature that's not technically set up to be evil, because when you see it, it's playful. It actually interacts with the humans in a nice way. But like the moment it feels threatened, it turned like it shut down as a defense mechanism. And then when it was being poked and prodded by the electrocution, then that's when it decided to attack.
Right.
And like you saw that slow progression of how it started being nice to something that's threatening now. Scary, and especially it was so small at the time.
Right, yeah.
And that was just the beginning of it. And the fact it grew throughout the whole film, the threat became bigger than it was.
And that, too, I found it to be very interesting about the thought process behind this creature is that it was basically a single-celled organism. That grew into this multi-celled organism, but they were all the same. Like, our cells are different and such, but this one, their cells were basically all unified. So every cell had an eye. Every cell breathed. Every cell worked to move this creature, which is interesting. And this creature was growing on the consumption of whether it be blood or that I couldn't quite ascertain.
It felt like it grew off of blood, because you can definitely see, well, that was one of the main components, because you can see it tracked blood.
It tracked blood,
like,
very
just
much so,
even
yeah.
blood droplets from hundreds of yards away, it can track that, and that's what like sustained its life.
Right.
So like it was like you literally this creature lived off of someone else's blood supply just to survive.
Sounds like
on
a vampire.
Yeah, it's like you're living off of someone else's life supply just so this thing could live. Hence the title Life.
Life.
Life. Right. The whole meaning of life. This organism needed other lives to live.
Right. So, but, and I do like the way that this, you know, I like the idea of it being, turning into this multi-celled, but a uniform cell. So anywhere, it's, you know, it's front and back, inside, and it could see 360 degrees. All of its cells worked to keep it mobile.
Yeah, let's talk about Kelvin's design, shall we? I thought it was pretty cool. It looked like a starfish translucent type of starfish.
And or ray and
It was like a mix of a lot of things, but they actually were inspired by deep sea creatures,
right.
Which I thought was interesting. They did there was an octopus that inspired them that had the ability to improvise and overcome obstacles just like this thing could, and it can squeeze into like little holes and go into unknown places and like contort the body so it can go to all these places you think it wouldn't, and and they like that translucent type of look, that is something you can find at the bedrock ocean.
And for us human audiences, there was a familiarity to it because of that research, I think, where it looked, it sort of looked like something that we may have seen before in a Discovery Channel special or something, but it wasn't. And they also did not want a man in suit, or they didn't want a man in suit kind of character like Alien. So they, he was all CG, but I liked its translucence. I like that aspect of it. And he was fast.
He was, and that's what made really him scary, fast. Too, because you didn't know where he was. He moved like a spider in a creepy way.
Yeah.
It's a terrible reference, but you know what I mean.
No, I know.
It moved too fast that you didn't know where it could go next, and I think that's what made the creature even more scary. The fact that it had intelligence also makes it scary, just like the creature in Alien as well. But the fact it can move fast and has the intelligence, and this is where the guy in that article was going off, where just the scientific aspect of Calvin, the genetic makeup of it, doesn't make sense, to the fact that it's like all cells, but it's one brain, one muscle, and one eye at the same time. He said that didn't make sense. I was like, yeah, but just go with it and suspend your disbelief. But if you suspend your disbelief, it makes this creature all the more scary.
Yeah, I agree, too. And there's nothing... How does that guy know what a sample from Mars would be like? I don't know.
I think he was just a hater.
Calvin was definitely a force to be reckoned with. Again, my only thing was it just didn't seem to have any weaknesses, which makes it way more of a formidable foe. Like, if you can't take it down, it almost seems like that whatever you do is useless, like, against it, that you have nothing to fend yourself with. And it was very, very strong.
Yeah.
Like, extremely strong.
All muscle, they said, too, as well. In fact, it could bend and contort in whichever way. I think the evolving process of Calvin was even more scary to watch, because as you saw it literally get bigger, it started forming a face. And I think that's what gave it the humanistic aspect, that this is another creature just trying to kill you. The fact that it kind of had like a facial, you can delineate some personality to it. And that's what made it scary.
And we definitely saw that at the end.
Oh, yeah.
We definitely saw that at the end, which I want to talk about. But I wanted to talk about, too, since we were talking about the good doctor, this guy is an up-and-comer. He was actually in Los Angeles auditioning in...
Arian Bakari?
Yeah, Arian Bakari. He was here. He was auditioning for Hidden Figures, Fences, in this movie. And he's from England, did a lot of BBC work. He's slowly but surely building a resume in the States. I believe after this movie he said he's going to be moving over here. And so he was brought in, and he had this funny story, he said, where he said his second audition was a Skype call, and then finally I had to do a screen test. He said it was April 1st, which April Fool's Day, and I'm ready
coming
and in
the
zone,
anniversary.
Right? And then the night before I put the candles down, that's how I get going for a job, he says, scented candles, wherever he is. So the next day he's getting ready to go on, and a phone call says, you got the job. And he was like, really? Like, this isn't a joke, right? You're right. Not April fooling me. And he goes, yeah, you got to go for screen test. So shut up. And is Daniel the director? He goes, you got the job. It's not April Fool's. And he was like thrilled. He said of all the movies that he, you know, Fences and Hidden Figures, which he loved both of them. Mm-hmm. But he said this was the one that he wanted to work with. So
that's great. Good for him.
Good for him.
That wasn't that long ago, and he's coming on his anniversary being April Fool's. April 1st tomorrow.
Tomorrow. Absolutely. So why don't we talk... I'm itching to talk about the ending, but you also brought up the music, which you said you really liked in this movie. Joe Ekstrand, who is the composer who's worked with Espinoza, this is his sixth time actually working together. So, the music was pretty good in this movie.
Yeah, the sixth time. The two magical classical ideas for, you know, Ekstrand for this film was the tonal shift to provide the atonal score that reinforced the film's thriller aspect. And then he said the score is more melodic, drawing on a classical cinema. In his first third of the movie. And then he said he didn't want to give away what was coming. Speaking about the ending, then it becomes atonal in the way that it's a terrifying thriller. So the whole sound effect that you hear, he says it starts off beautiful and melodic, and then in the third, it becomes more ominous and dissonant.
Yeah,
dissonant, and I completely believe that. And the fact this is like his biggest. Biggest score that he has yet to compose and stuff, and it was performed by a 100-piece orchestra with the 32 voice choir.
Big, you know.
That's big.
And it's interesting too because he talks about classical music again. Classical music in science fiction, not a stranger, you know. No. Obviously 2001, and even in Alien there's some classical, there's a classical music cue in Alien as well. But in regards to life, you're right. The opening tracking shot, you know, we have this classical music, which lends to a feeling of like warmth, familiarity amongst these characters. I'm getting to meet everybody. It's good background music, and music can bring people together. And classical music, any kind of music, actually, once there's a tonal shift in that music, you know, that can change everything. It can change from being lighthearted, hey, we're scientists and we love to be explorers, to, oh shit, we got to get the hell out of here. Like, what are we going to do? Mm-hmm. And that movie also has a three-act
structure,
you know, as well. And I thought it worked very, very well.
Yeah, I really like the music, and we're always talking about movies and the music and the moments where you like always remember it. But I felt I heard, because you're not in space, you can't really technically can't hear sound,
right?
And but so the music always, you know, accompanies everything that you see visually on screen. I thought the music was beautiful, especially in the moments where it was silent, where. Mm-hmm. Needed no music, especially when they're freezing. They're literally starting to freeze to death, and it's only those last two on board. Sure. There was no music, but then when like the ideas were brewing, it was like you slowly brought the music back in. But and then also when the astronaut was drowning to death outside, mm-hmm. and there was literally really no words, and you just saw her drowning, you felt the music was rising. I heard the music all the other stuff.
Yeah, and really it helped. And again, it helped build tension and suspense. But it never overtook the movie. It was never bigger than the movie, but it added. It made the movie seem bigger, but the music itself never was bigger than the movie. Which to me, that's the. One of the worst things that a score can do is overpower the movie that you're watching.
Right.
So why don't we talk a little bit about the end? And did you see it coming? The twist? You know, at least I liked it. You saw it? When did you see? Okay, so we know the end. Life, Calvin, our two main characters, the two who are left. We have David and Miranda. And Miranda, I like too. I like that character.
Before the ending, really. Like, I liked these two actors. I mean, I love Jake Gyllenhaal and everything he touches. I think he's fantastic. Rebecca Ferguson's amazing. Have you ever seen The White Queen? No one watched The White Queen, and it was fantastic. I watched every single episode when it aired, and I was one of the only 100 people watching it. And I think she's a great actress. Both of these together, the chemistry was great.
I agree.
And I was kind of expecting a romance, but I'm kind of glad that they didn't go the romantic route.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I thought that somebody should be seeing them and maybe putting them in a movie together again. I thought that they had a very good chemistry
Not
together.
Not so much a thriller, but maybe a natural romance. Whatever. I would totally watch it.
Yeah.
I loved their relationship on screen because they were always there for each other. And there was a scene earlier in the movie, they're just talking. And you can generally tell that they generally care about each other.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. So I was rooting for these two throughout the whole film. At the end, I was like, everyone else, not to sound mean, but I was like, it's okay if you die. Like, I won't feel bad.
Right.
But, like, these were the two people that I think the main audience were probably rooting for to survive at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and Miranda, she doesn't quite become Ripley, but she's like the CDC. She's the person that, like, when it gets to the bad case scenario, she's the person that's got to figure out containment. She's got to put up the firewalls and think of every single worst possible thing that could happen on board, and to keep from something escaping and getting to Earth. That's her job. That I always liked in a horror movie, because it's when you pit a professional, someone who's supposed to know their work, right? And they're in a situation that's even above their expertise, and they're supposed to be the best at it. So that causes for good, you know, plot points and how do we get out of this jam. And, you know, David Jordan, you're right. I mean, Jake Gyllenhaal can play the everyman and the sympathetic.
Likeable.
Very likeable.
Likeable. There wasn't anything about both of these characters that I disliked about them. They were there doing the job. They were likeable. You can watch them throughout the whole film. They cared about each other and the people on the team. I really liked them. And I think their chemistry was just, it was just really great pairing those two together.
Agreed.
And I just love Jake Gyllenhaal, and he's great.
Yeah, agreed. And so their idea is, we have two life pods on this ship. We're going to divert the Calvin into one life pod that our good doctor is going to be in, and he's going to shoot himself. He's going to sacrifice himself.
Very noble of him.
And Miranda is going to, the other life pod, program it to go back to Earth. Oh, well, of course, shit happens, to say the least. Both pods get jettisoned. So, okay, I want to know, when did you figure out, because we don't see the we see the various insides of the pod, but we don't know their geography. We're led to assume that things are still going as planned, where Miranda's going to be landing on Earth and going through the atmosphere, and Jake Gyllenhaal's flying out into space. But then when the pod lands, and
it's actually the alien that lands to Earth.
It's Jake Gyllenhaal's, and then we see the tragic thing of
the wrong pods went to the wrong areas.
Gets buffeted off, and she's now doomed.
Yeah, the alien is not on Earth, you guys, and we're all dead.
So when did you, we did talk about just before we went live. When did you figure out the switcheroo?
I figured it out when they were jettisoned, and there was the moment where they were, like, things were crashing into them, and, the minute ran into, like, a piece of the ISS, and it kind of, like, set the course of the pod off just a little bit. That's when I saw it, because there was a moment on screen when all this was happening. One was crashing into something, and there was a moment where you saw both of the pods, and you don't know which one is which.
Right.
And I was like, oh, crap, they switched it on us. And because you're still led to believe that they're going off into the proper direction. But when you saw that one shot, and both of them are, like, squiggling around on screen.
Yeah, did they hit, like, did they collide?
Yeah, too? They collide for a split second. You're right. Like, oh crap, which one is which? They switched it on us, and that's when 2 minutes later, I was like, yep, I saw that coming.
Mm-hmm.
So literally, when they collided into each other, and you think that they're still on their proper courses, no.
Yeah, I mean, I thought Espinoza did a good job at working out the twist, because even though we went inside each of the relative pods, mm-hmm. and we saw the characters, we still didn't know. You're still led to believe that things are going as they planned it to go. You really don't find out. Like, when that pod touches down, for me, it was like sort of like, oh, that wouldn't that be interesting if that was actually Jake Gyllenhaal's? And then when that ship comes across, and you're like, oh, well, that sucks. And then they cut to... her, now you know. Now
she's
just know the
screaming
rest of the
out
story.
In space, completely helpless. Is like, oh, helpless. Girl's literally going out into space right now. But I hope she meets up with George Clooney. So
good one.
Like, I saw it coming. I didn't mind the twist, though, because I thought it made the movie, like, you remember the movie, you remember the ending. And I think that's what would make people remember this film.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was well done. Espinoza was like, was there ever going to be, like, in no iteration of this movie, there was never going to be a quote-unquote happy ending. Yeah. It was shot to be realistic, he said. He said it was shot to make a science fiction movie that ties into this other great American genre, which is noir. Many of the fundamental alphabets that we have in cinema were created in the noir era. When I met the producers, I told them, I completely understand that this ending might not be a preferable choice, but for me, it was a fundamental part of the reason why I wanted to do it. So, and they actually were completely supportive and let him film the ending. So I liked it too. I mean, to me, it wasn't, for the confines of science fiction, You sort of kind of get it because, you know, if and when a sequel, you have something to build off of. I didn't find it complete. For me, the tragedy was, you know, our good CDC type specialist.
Oh, yeah. Who's
like, that was.
Who's now literally helpless.
Helpless. Absolutely helpless.
I felt bad for her. I was like, crap. And I liked her. And now she's off to her death.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And and this is where, too, I think for the first time, you had brought it up earlier about the face of the creature. This mm-hmm. is like when it pins Gyllenhaal's out. Again, showing its strength. Like, he's supposed to be trying to maneuver as a pilot.
Yeah, the control.
Can't do it. So, and this is where we see the creature's face as we look at a point of view from our good doctor.
And then, like, I love that ending shot, though, that the, you know, that eagle eye perspective when you see all these boats slowly going. I was like, no, you're just giving it more bodies to feed off of. Ready to go, you guys.
Here's the thing. There are certain things, and I get that could be, like, where he landed in some Asian territory.
Yeah,
and I get that there could be an English barrier, but I always thought that, you know, they always say love is universal. I also think no is universal too. Like, what part of no? Don't open this door. It's like, don't touch this. Oh, okay. It's like the very end of Time Bandits. Ah, okay. So,
well, but like they were trying, they were trying to help Jake Gyllenhaal. I was like, oh, something just literally crash landed into the ocean. Let's go check it out.
Right.
So, like, I get that innate curiosity that one would have if you were to witness something like that. But yeah, the fact that the alien's there and he's now on Earth, when the whole movie was like, we cannot let this get to Earth. And then it still ends up being on Earth was, I think. I don't want to say disappointing, but it was satisfactory, though. Yeah. You're like, shoot, there's the irony. Damn.
Yeah, there's. Well, to me, the irony was, what if his only weakness was salt water? So that pretty much kills your sequel. But yeah, I mean, obviously, they were going for that little Twilight Zone effect. And also, if there are prospects of a sequel, We have a starting
well,
point.
Well, I mean, Espinoza said that there's no sequel coming. Yeah. It ends like that. It's an American pulp fiction, not like the movie, but pulp fiction, like The Twilight Zone, The Night of the Living Dead. Huh. He says, if you look at the American movies from the 1900s, those kinds of endings solely exist in American cinema. It's great, great American tradition of those great turns. It's almost like a joke on life. That's why I put that Poppy song at the end with the credit song. So, like, if they were to expect a sequel, they would have had, like, the orchestral instrumental music and it had a more serious ending. But the fact that he put a pop song at the end, just like, yep, it's over.
Yeah, it's over.
Mm-hmm. And, but they also said that, the Reese, you know, the, one of the writers, he said, it's an interesting idea that they dropped that, that Kelvin can possibly reproduce, and like being in the ocean on the coast of Indonesia or Vietnam, wherever it is that they landed, it'd be an interesting thing to write if Kelvin could reproduce. So it's not just Kelvin, it's multiple organisms just like Kelvin that would literally take over the Earth. Mm-hmm. They thought of that for a sequel, but I don't think there's a sequel coming to this.
Yeah. I wanted to talk, because you mentioned pop song music, we were talking about the orchestration. It's really interesting because music came into what Daniel Espinosa found to be the most challenging part of making this movie was the opening sequence, he said. And he goes, to your point where you've said that there's claustrophobia, Espinosa says that made it quite damning to get the camera through these spaces and having the performers, and there was a rhythm to doing it. So what they did was they put music over it to get the right rhythm for the actors. So there's so there's a rhythm going on, and he had music composed before we started shooting because it was noir. He asked the composer to write something that had a Bernard Herrmann feel to it, and then I was and then I told them my favorite movie of all time in space is 2001, which we mentioned
Odyssey,
here.
Of course.
So,
well, that's interesting, so and that helps with sense. The production aspect, because a lot of times, for the most part, the score is composed after the film, after everything has filmed and wrapped and already, for the most part, edited. When we talk about movies where the directors usually put music on
a temp track.
Yeah, a temp track, or like would put actually play music live on set to get the actors in whatever emotional space they need to be, but to also help with choreography of just camera movement. I find that fascinating.
Camera movement and for your actors. So they have, you know, they're using musical cues as to their movement. I find that to be very fascinating as well.
Yeah, and it reminds me, you know, the movie Birdman. I mean, that was like one full long shot. Like, and that was a dance in and of itself. It kind of felt like the same way a little bit. But less jarring.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. So let's talk a little bit about... we can talk a little bit about the marketing of this movie before we go into reception and such. The marketing on this movie from Sony, I thought, was good. I mean, it appealed to me because I like these kind of movies. It appealed to me because I enjoy Jake Gyllenhaal, Ryan Reynolds, Rebecca Ferguson, who I'm very familiar with in the Mission Impossible movie, which she was great. It's a science fiction horror. You could tell that it looked like Alien, but because you had Gyllenhaal and Reynolds in it, you're like, okay.
Who's the male dominant in this film?
How's this going to all work out? Trailers were good. We were talking before about Ryan Reynolds, and their biggest messed up for me is releasing. I forget where I saw it, whether it was online or whether it was a TV spot, is letting the cat out of the bag that Ryan Reynolds dies.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, to me, it would have been better if that had been more of a surprise.
See, I didn't see that because, like, I always saw the one trailer that, like, they and I didn't really see anything else. So the one trailer where it established the ISS, everyone on the crew, and then you got the, you know, Jake and Rebecca and Ryan and their personalities and stuff. And then you always see that moment where the alien finally attacks Derry's character. Sure. And I saw that over and over. Because, you know, we go to movies every single week.
We do.
I saw this trailer probably 20 times before I saw this film. But, like, nothing, even watching this film over or trailer over and over again that wants to spoil the fact that Ryan was going to die.
No, not at all. And, you know, it was a decent trailer. They only had one trailer, which is this day and age.
That I saw 20-plus times.
And to break it down, when I'm talking about a trailer, they had one theatrical trailer. Mm-hmm. I know that they had various online materials. They had various television spots. But regarding a theatrical, in today's day and age, at the very least, you're getting three. You're getting what they call a teaser trailer. Then you're getting your first trailer. And then it's usually maybe a month and a half prior to release, you're getting
the final trailer.
A final trailer. This one only had the one that they milked. Their print campaign was okay, I felt. It was that portal with the hand.
Oh, yeah.
You know, on it. Yeah, in the globe. You know, their marketing was okay. You know, and I thought for a 50... Now, the production budget actually sort of kind of surprised me. 58 mil.
58 million.
58 million.
But I can believe that, too. Yeah. Cause, I mean, there's obviously VFX with the creature. Mm-hmm. But with the whole wiring. And the cinematography looked beautiful, though.
I mean, I don't disagree.
Watching it was gorgeous.
I don't disagree.
Oh. Despite the fact everyone was dying, it was pretty to look at.
Well, let me ask you again. I had mentioned I had seen it at a Cinemark theater. And I saw it in their XD. So I saw it on a premium large format environment. It looked great. It looked and sounded really good too. In fact, oh my God, when the creature's running around a room, the sound design was quite big. I mean, it's a good movie to see in a theater. You know, it was designed from both its cinematography, the way it's directed, to be seen in cinema.
Yeah.
So, and the cinematographer, Seamus McGarvey, who, you know, he's worked on some movies. He's like the Avengers, Godzilla, Nocturnal Animals.
Oh, my goodness.
Again, if you're going to make a noir movie and put that into a science fiction movie, yeah, go with the guy that did Nocturnal Animals, which is Jake Gyllenhaal.
And we talked about that. Yeah, well, you weren't here for that one. But no. We talked about that. That looked pretty, as disturbing as the movie that was, it was pretty to look at.
Yeah, yeah. And again, that, to, you know, Nocturnal Animals is, well, that's contemporary American noir. Right,
oh yeah,
there.
For sure. Just,
and it's a
messed
dark
up movie,
film,
but go watch it.
But it's a really good movie.
Yeah, go watch it.
And as Marissa said, it is beautiful to look at. So I understand.
I think Seamus did a great job because there are moments when it visually looks great, but the moments when it needs to be dark and gritty, it definitely feels mm-hmm. that too. Like and tonally, you got that throughout this entire film.
And Espinoza has been, you know, vocal about, talks about the ending. I want it to be noir. If you're going to hire, go with the guy that did Nocturnal Animals, which is America's contemporary noir. So we're talking about $58 million production budget, which for a science fiction movie is very lean, I think.
Oh, yeah.
So, and I think it gives Espinoza cred, too, because he was able to work on that kind of a budget and really give this movie a really big screen, much higher budgeted feel to it. So, you know, when you're talking all total budget, hard drives, advertising, it's had to be pushing 90 to 100 million. You know, that's just an estimate right there. But now we go into the reception, which to me was very, very fascinating. Currently, box office-wise, on its opening weekend, it did okay at best. It opened up. Opening weekend. It came in number four, and it did only $12 million.
Yeah, like 12.6.
So, you know, currently as of March 30th, its total is 16.7. Now worldwide, I mean, it's foreign.
Is about 15.8.
So we've got about 32 million worldwide, but domestically, that's sort of kind of tough. And when you're on Rotten Tomatoes, it gets a 66%, which isn't
necessarily
exactly
not terrible. We've seen better movies that have lower scores on Rotten Tomatoes, and Rotten Tomatoes is like ruining, you know, how we perceive movies, I think. But, I mean, it's not a terrible score. That's actually very doable.
It's not a terrible score, particularly for this type of genre.
Yeah.
Especially if you're going to blend science fiction and horror. And the key word is horror, because a lot of people don't necessarily like horror. That's the genre that's going to divide people, because some people enjoy it, some people don't, and they're going to find they're going to find ways in which not to like it. So when you're in that mid-range, that just means to me the people that enjoy that genre are liking the movie.
It.
So 66% I would go in going, okay, I get it, that's not horrible. But what really surprised the hell out of me is the cinema score.
Cinema score, really low.
The lowest I have seen of a movie
since we've covered this
year. This year, with a C+.
C+.
Which is dismal. Dismal when it comes to word of mouth. Now, I don't know, the audience that I saw it with seemed to be really liking this movie. Yelling, talking back at the screen, screaming when they were meant to scream. There were no unintentional laughter going on. The audience seemed to be really into it. So when I saw C+, I was a little bit shocked. I mean, what did you think?
I was shocked. I don't think it deserves a C+. I would say solid, strong B+, maybe. Yeah, that's fairly low. But like IMDb is on 7.9, which that's not terrible either. That's fairly high in IMDb standards. I think the thing with this film, it's divided between the people who are big fans of horror and the big fans of just sci-fi. It kind of, you know, caters to two demographics here, or like two different genres. So like if you're a humongous fan of sci-fi, you might not like this. I can see like a lower score on that. But if you're a humongous fan of horror, you may. And I think it balances, those two genres balance each other out. Hence the average score.
But that's a, to me, that's a below than average score, especially when you're talking about word of mouth. For me, on the Dimitri movie meter scale, one being made me angry, four being was wicked good. This one didn't make me angry, and I walked out going, well, that's better than some other knockoffs that I've seen for sure. And for the, oh, it was brevity too. I liked it too. It wasn't, it was an hour and 40 plus minutes,
like,
or 40.
An hour and 45 minutes. Right. It wasn't a long, like, Aliens is a slow burn of a movie.
And
that's a good movie, Alien. I'm just talking about the first one. But, like, that's a 2 hour plus movie. It's a long movie.
Yeah, but that's
a long movie. And that's a slow burn of a movie. This one, I thought the pacing was so much faster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but it had its moments to breathe, especially when they're freezing to death and they're about to die, and they're reading the book, Good Night Moon. Like, it had its moments of calm after the storm that we saw. And I enjoyed that, because I thought that brought back the humanistic elements to a sci-fi film.
Yeah, I wasn't bored.
No.
The pacing was good. You got to credit it for its brevity. If I was going to talk about some plot points, I mean, a couple of ones that got me is, how did I get the biologist or scientist guy. I understand that he's a paraplegic, but how did he not know that? And how the hell did the creature get on his leg? Like, how did Calvin get there? Like, not knowing. So that was like, nobody else noticed. Like, he didn't notice there was an extra bulge. Like, and then my other one was...
Yeah, right? Like, it just, like, slimed like a leech or something.
Yeah. And it was big enough at that time, too. It wasn't little baby Calvin. This was a bigger Calvin. The other one was, and I get it, they're trying to, like, they're flushing out all the oxygen.
All right.
Right? Then I was thinking, well, how is this guy going from module to module? Like, there's no oxygen in there. They just flushed it out. Like, what's going on? Maybe there was a deleted scene that said, like, to me, it would have been better, like, get out of that module because you're going to be out of air, and he's got to, like, race through as they're like flushing it out. But
there was the moms just like, no, he's going towards him, like go away. And I was like, no, they just suck the oxygen out. And there were moments where you're like, well, what are they doing?
Yeah.
But again, I think it's like when you're disoriented in such a small space and everything's happening, you're not really thinking clearly anyways.
Yeah. I'm curious, like, do we have, is there anybody watching us live? Because I'd be curious if they would give us, if they would give Life a C+. And I'm assuming if they're online and they've seen it and they're watching this, usually if you hated a movie, like, because we're celebrating
it. I didn't hate this movie. And that's the thing, because like, I do like my general sci-fi horror films in this one. Like, I liked, and don't hate me, but like I like this. Like, I liked Alien.
Yeah, I will.
I liked Alien in certain aspects. I think Alien is too slow of a movie for me personally.
Aliens are much more, to me, Aliens very suspenseful, very atmospheric,
it had and way its more moments to build
phobic. You know, in this movie, look, I was more concerned about you making it through this. But after I watched it, I was like, you know, Marissa and people like you. Because there are many, you know, you're in a class that doesn't particularly like horror. So, and that's, I get it.
Right.
And that's man, woman, child, too. So I'm not just specifically saying, oh, women don't like horror movies. I'm just saying, I know that you don't. And I walked out of this going, no, this is like a date night movie.
It was doable. I didn't have nightmares.
Yeah, it's
I slept peacefully with the lights off.
It's a very palpable horror movie that I think, you know, I think it's enjoyable. It's definitely not a C+. So, we do have one Tony Weru. I'm sorry if I messed up your last name, Tony, but Tony, if you're online, you say you would like to see a sequel to this just to see what Calvin does to Earth. Yeah, I think Calvin could wreak a lot of havoc.
He could decimate everybody.
You know, on Earth. Yeah, well, I appreciate the comment. I appreciate you being here, Marissa, and talking about life. Life in general. And, And so where can people support you, find you outside of Anatomy of a Movie?
You can follow me on Twitter at SarahFeeningTV. You can download our rundown with all of our awesome notes in the description. There's a lot of good things about, you know, just the technical aspect of this film that we talked about. But you're in our notes. Go check it out. Yeah, SarahFeeningTV and all platforms.
And folks, I'd be more than happy if you support me on Twitter. I'm at DMovies1701. Please continue to watch us as Anatomy of a Movie. We got a ton of movies upcoming. You know, things like, well, there's Ghost in the Shell, which lots of talk about that movie, and Scarlett Johansson. You know, and then
we've had our other movies that we've already talked about. Gravity, Martian, heck, even
all the movies we referenced.
The Space Between Us, which was, you know, another movie about Mars and stuff. So, like, we've been covering the movies that take place in space. So, go check out those too.
Absolutely. So, until next time, folks, thank you very much for tuning in, listening, watching us. Until next time, we'll see you at the movies. Bye.
Garo, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.